Okay, Ultimate Warrior. What? What's this? He just gave me.
Wait a minute!
Whoa!
Bravo!
What?
Falling through an elbow!
See, I told you, McMahon, that he couldn't push up that big John character.
Chance.
Yes, he did. He set his weight on him and the Warrior collapsed.
From Television City in Hollywood,
this podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Greetings from Allentown is not taped in front of a live studio audience.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 186 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, after some real deep thought put into picking a show this week, and I ended up choosing this one for reasons that I'll get into in a minute, this is WWF Superstars from November 11th, 1989. It's actually kind of a long-standing request from my dear friend Merrill. Now, he probably doesn't even remember. I think offhand at a Bruins game like 2 years ago, I asked him, hey, if I were to ever do a show, what would get you to listen to it? And he said, how about that one where they did the push-up contest with the Ultimate Warrior, Dino Bravo? So I said, okay. And 2 years plus later, here we are, and he's never listened to a single show that I've done. But that's fine. I mean, hey, a push-up contest? Why not? That's like the first thing that comes to mind. Well, it all has to do with the people involved. I guess he's just a big fan of Dino Bravo. But I did think about other shows as well, which I am going to get to these ones soon. In fact, I think next week I'm going to do this is totally random, an episode of WWF Spotlight from December of 1987. But I have to do it for reasons including, well, let's get a Jake versus Honky Tonk Man match. Fine. It's got the If You Only Knew video with all the wrestlers. Fine, but it also had commercials in it, which, as I said in a chat earlier, like, basically gave me an erection when, like, a One Day at a Time promo comes on. I'm like, oh my God, it opens the door. But the reason why I ended up settling on this one earlier today is I saw there's a dead turkey in my yard, which, I mean, you've heard me talk about how turkeys are assholes on this program for several years now. But as I go over and look, you know, there's like a carcass and like all these, you know, varmints and stuff, like eating away at it. I probably should take a shovel and chuck it into the woods. It's like totally mixed emotions.
I mean, I'm smiling, but I am very fucking furious.
I guess there are certain positives to just letting nature happen. First of all, I don't have to fly all the way to the Serengeti to see it happen. I can just, you know, open the blinds and see that sort of thing happen in my own backyard. Not that my passport does me any good and could get me there anyway. By the way, it was one of the young turkeys, so it was a smaller carcass. Thank God, but I'm gonna have to take care of it. I mean, I don't want too much of this, okay? I don't like the rabbit that invades my yard and sometimes craps in the grass. I mean, even though it's not very much, it's just very annoying. And while I dislike turkeys immensely, I really don't want them murdered on my property. I'd like them murdered just over the line so that when turkeys come in, they approach the property line and they say, oh, okay, yeah, this is where that turkey got murdered. This is where Glenn got murdered. I don't know if turkeys actually name each other, but, like, what the hell? Anyway, I should get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com, blah, 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 blah. And on Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod, that is at GF Allentown Pod. And be sure you do not miss the GFA Live running series that me and Keithy have, the best of the World Wrestling Federation, as I've been fond of saying, because I now have it in my head as Vince McMahon saying it that way. We most recently covered volume number 13, and it was a strong one, except for the two fabulous Moolah matches. Once we got past that, it was pretty fine after that. Like, it's like WrestleMania 2 in that sort of way. So how do I carry on from a dead turkey story? Well, I mentioned a week ago how I've been cleaning out my mother's house, and in making my way up to the attic, which is not very neat at all, and it's very hot up there because it's very well insulated. I'll say that's one of the strengths of my childhood house, is when they finish the attic up there, they put in so much freaking insulation that I'm like sweating my balls off, and you know, it's like 50 degrees out and I have the windows open, and it doesn't matter because just how hot it is up there. But again, once again, like last week, I am finding just these unbelievable things as I'm going through, like a U.S. savings bond that matured in 2003. Okay, you might want to go cash that in now. I don't know how the tax situation might have changed versus in 2003. I know I paid taxes on the interest for ones that I cashed in last year. But finally, I'm going to be moving to a different room the next week because I want to feel like I'm making a little bit more progress. But as I go through the attic, once again, I am finding some crazy stuff. So once again, here is installment number two of Crazy Crap That I Found in My Mother's House. That's a pretty stiff competition this week, which is good because I believe I found approximately 3,100 different kinds of coat hangers, which I don't know how the hell, like, why did we as a society, why can't we just agree on what is the best coat hanger? Oh, and why does my mother have every single kind of coat hanger dating to 1964 in the house? And why are they stacked up in five or six different laundry bins? They're all distinct laundry bins. They're not the same. They're completely different in every way. So here, I got a top three for this week. Number three, there's a lot of interesting family stuff going down the line, like all the cards from when my father passed away 15 years ago, which, you know, isn't that long ago. I just found the blueprints to the house, which that I found that mildly interesting. I don't know if they were the actual real blueprints, but coming in at number three is my grandmother's Social Security card, which was issued in the year 1936, which my mother said, you know, when did they start issuing? So, I mean, I've said, well, Roosevelt became president in 33. It took a little bit to get it going, so it's got to be, you know, one of the first ones. So, like, I thought that her Social Security number was going to be, like, 19 or something. But no, it's the full nine-digit number like you would see now. Coming in at number two, and I could not believe that I found this, but given the number of dolls that are in that house, a bunch of Cabbage Patch Kid dolls, which I was specifically instructed not to throw away, probably because my mother went through hell to get them back in 83. This, coming in at number two, is the Barbie doll that I took away from my sister's collection in like 1989 and gave a haircut to because I was fond of Brutus the Barber Beefcake. And I could tell which one it was because basically has like the Bridget Nielsen look from Rocky IV, which I'd assume was the style at the time since it was the late 80s and that would have been the last Rocky film that had been on, and I probably would have seen it multiple times at that point. But coming in at number one, and I cannot believe that this is still there and that I didn't steal it at some point and perhaps even drink it, a bottle unopened of Korbel 2000 Times Square brand champagne. So basically, the special edition stuff that Korbel came out with for the millennium 1999 into 2000. Here's this bottle. It's got like dust all over it. Completely unopened. Now, I looked and I saw you can drink champagne after all that time. Problem is, the bubbles go away and the flavor just really doesn't hold up. So to answer your question, no, I am probably not going to drink it, but I'm also not going to open it. I don't know what to do with it, like, honestly. Like, should I, like, water plants? I have absolutely no idea. But the winner, the craziest thing that I found in my mother's house this week, a Korbel 2000 Times Square Millennium bottle of champagne. I also considered doing that Superstars from September of 1988, mainly because on the day that this show drops, it'll be the exact 32-year anniversary of the unveiling of Akeem by Slick. But I gotta say, I'm still probably not emotionally prepared to talk about, like, Akeem being unveiled to the world from deepest, darkest Africa. And another one that I thought about was from September of 87, where the Macho Man hassles Jimmy Hart, which, you know, might be kind of like the actual face turn for him, but, you know, that'll certainly be good another time. But this one here, this taping of Superstars, this is actually the third show in the taping, so maybe you don't get the greatest crowd for it if they're taping it in something of an order. 7,800 in Wheeling, West Virginia on October 2nd. And some big stuff happened on this, such as the debut of Al Perez. All right, so maybe the Latin heartthrob Al Perez didn't set the world on fire with World Wrestling Federation fans, but most of the action on this taping was taking place in the tag team division. As I said, this is the third of the three shows, and 2 weeks before this, Haku was teaming with Andre the Giant for the first time, which didn't seem like anything was amiss because they were going to be on the same side at the Survivor Series on Thanksgiving night. The Brainbusters, who were then the tag team champions, visited ringside. Once again, no big deal because they're all Survivor Series teammates, and as we're going to see on this show, they want to make a point that, you know, some sort of unity thing going on with each of these teams, whether it be the promos or actually showing up at ringside before, after, or during guys' matches. The previous week, on November 4th, 89 Superstars, the Brainbusters lose the tag team titles back to Demolition in 5 minutes in rather shocking fashion. Now, I'm kind of blowing up my spot because that's the update segment towards the beginning of this episode. But the Brainbusters were protected in that Tully Blanchard was technically not the legal man in the ring, which kind of makes me wonder, why did they do that? If clearly the Brainbusters gave their notice and their last night was going to be the Survivor Series, so why are they going to great lengths to protect Tully Blanchard in this case, who's the one who takes the pin? Well, I just want to remind you that much has been made about the drug test failure of Tully Blanchard and how they did him dirty, basically kept him from getting a job in WCW, but also screwed over Arn Anderson, where they decided to not give him as much money because they decided he wasn't worth as much without Tully there. That drug test failure doesn't happen until the November 1st challenge taping. So it's kind of screwy in my head where the drug test failure happens before they lose the tag team titles, but it's them losing it on TV. So there was kind of a bit of a lag in the taping of the WWF around this time. There's no feature match here, which I was kind of surprised by, considering that it is a sweeps period in November. And but here you get the angle with Dino Bravo and the Ultimate Warrior, a test of strength, as it were. But it is notable that there are some of the bigger names on this show. Now, while Mr. Perfect certainly was not peaking at this point, he is heading rapidly towards the Hulk Hogan program, which really kicks off in earnest on the Saturday Night's Main Event that airs at the end of November of 1989. Roddy Piper is on the show, Ted DiBiase. Jimmy Snuka is faded, but, you know, as I said the last time he was on, that Superfly Splash still had cachet in terms of the number of light bulbs from the cameras that you would see. So without any further ado, and of course, one of the things that I'm most excited about these type of shows is you get the Survivor Series team promos, which is there's little that I like more in wrestling. Like, yes, I have become jaded with the modern product and a lot of, you know, when you look back, professional wrestling as a business has a lot of problems. Survivor Series team promos from the late 80s are not one of them. And they represent the soul and the innocence. Well, actually, there is no innocence, particularly where Jimmy Snuka's Survivor Series team is involved. But without any further ado, why don't we get right to it? WWF Superstars for November 11th, 1989.
We'll be right back.
I am delighted to report that there was a Saved by the Bell episode airing on November 11th, 1989, perhaps even against the superstars of wrestling in certain markets. And the name of the episode was The Mamas and the Papas, which has nothing to do with the musical act from the 60s, I think it was. The plot of the show was, as a class project, the gang pairs up in mock marriages for the week. Slater's marriage to Jesse comes apart when he turns out to be the domineering type. Lisa's marriage to Screech is driving her crazy. Meanwhile, Slater tries to get Screech to break up Zach and Kelly's marriage so that he can still have a chance with her. Well, it's kind of funny because Zach and Kelly actually end up getting married. And at one point in the episode, I think Slater threatens to send Jesse to the moon, which feels a little violent for a Saturday morning show, you know, something of an innocent show like what Saved by the Bell was supposed to be, not like some of Aaron Spelling's other work. Of course, they're out in freaking Malibu, Bayside, California, whatever the hell you want to call it. And we're going to go to the opposite, basically the opposite end of the spectrum to Wheeling, West Virginia, a place that I've been. I went to the dog track when I was visiting my friend Bob when he was going to college in West Virginia. Now, Vince, he was brought up in the sticks in North Carolina. And, you know, he probably, you know, has it out for certain areas. But then again, Wheeling is more of a city, of course. So tell us all about it, Vince, because it's that period of time where you're doing that.
Wheeling is located on the Ohio River and is the home of Jamboree USA, the weekly concert series held at a Capitol Music Hall. Wheeling is also known for its Suspension Bridge, which is the oldest of its type in the Western Hemisphere and a national civil engineering landmark. Welcome, everyone, to the Superstars of Wrestling. I'm Vince McMahon, and joining me yet another national landmark, Jesse the Body Ventura.
You know, McMahon, we're here in Wheeling. It's famous for Wetzel's Cave.
Wetzel's Cave, yeah.
Yeah, what's in there? They make moonshine or what?
I gotta find that place.
I don't know anything about Jamboree USA, but what I can tell you about that suspension bridge is that it was the longest in the world from the year 1849 through 1851.
Wow, spanning two decades.
And here's a sentence that I never thought I would utter in my entire existence. I love the way that Vince McMahon says suspension bridge.
Suspension bridge!
I'm gonna try to say it that way from now on. Like, if I ever go into Boston again, although I did over the weekend, walked around for 7 miles, as it turned out, masked the entire time, I'd take the Zakim Bridge in because it's one of my favorite.
Suspension Bridge!
Anyway, moving on, because there's a lot of good Jesse and Vince banter on this program, and we start with our opening bout, the Rowdy Roddy Piper taking on the Brooklyn Brawler. And immediately, with Piper's music and the bagpipes playing, they have a very fun conversation about bagpipes.
Stand at attention, Jesse! Don't they kind of just grate on you? See, they got a horrible sound to them. That's the purpose of bagpipes. To grate on your nerves?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because the Scottish warriors years ago, that's exactly what they did. When you heard the bagpipes coming, you could hear them from miles away. It was not a pleasant sound, so you knew you were about ready to get your rear end kicked.
No, so you got irritated and it got you in a fighting mood, obviously. You wanted to silence them. That's one way to look at it. That's how I'd have viewed it.
Well, you know, you're a little bit different, you know, in probably a lot of respects.
Nah, McMahon, I'm considered mainstream America, don't you think?
No, thank goodness.
I'm the immoral minority.
Not knowing much about the history of Scotland, I thought Vince was just pulling that out of his ass to make Piper seem like more of a badass or whatever, but apparently, during the Highland Uprisings in the early 1700s, they used bagpipes as part of that, and the government in London tried to basically ban the bagpipes, but it was kept alive in secret. So Vince is mostly right there. It is strange. Now, I don't know why Jesse is so irritated by them. I think if you stand too close to bagpipes, they start to become irritating, but and maybe it's the fact that when you hear them, you expect to hear like Amazing Grace and it's sad because it's somebody's funeral. But I love that back and forth with Vince and Jesse. That's why they're so great. By the way, of course, at my funeral, I would like bagpipes and I would like them to play the Mr. Belvedere theme. So Piper, he's got his feud going on with Ravishing Rick Rude that had started before SummerSlam. Comes down and moons Rude during the... He just showed his ask Bobby what happened. And it was some good stuff, but it was the kind of feud where you never got, like, a determining finish for either guy. It's not like Rude went over with the Rude Awakening or Piper won a match clean that I remember. But with Roddy Piper, it never really seemed to matter, at least in the WWF. Never seemed to matter that none of his feuds ever really seemed to have much of a resolution to it. Like, here with Rude in 89, it kind of, you know, peters out after a while. Then he has the feud with Bad News Brown that ends in, like, a double countout at WrestleMania 6. And so on and so forth. Like, him and DiBiase, I mean, they had matches, and Piper was losing some of them by, like, the referee stoppage. I know at the first house show that I went to, it ended like that. But I think it's a credit to his character where that sort of stuff didn't matter. And it really shouldn't. I mean, you know, you're more invested in the character rather than, oh my God, I hope, you know, the wins and losses thing, which I know AEW makes a big deal about with their standings. That kind of boxes them into a corner. Piper probably has more like non-wins, non-losses, like as a percentage of his total matches than just about anybody. Now that I'm pulling out of my ass is Lombardi, his push as the Brooklyn Brawler, which was in the calendar year 1989, is long gone and hard to find, in the words of former Red Sox broadcaster Ned Martin. He does attack early and gains an edge, and then he tosses his cigar at Piper, or his stogie, or whatever. And that's a huge mistake. He didn't do his homework, because nothing pisses, as we've learned at WrestleMania 5, nothing pisses off Roddy Piper quite like, you know, putting tobacco in front of him. He just has it out for the tobacco industry. It's like he's Don Draper saying that he doesn't want to work tobacco accounts anymore. As Roddy then fires up, and we do get a quick inset promo from Rick Rude addressing their current feud.
Well, 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 Mr. Piper, aren't you looking vicious today? Well, you better save that vicious attitude and bring it with you to the Survivor Series. Because I want the world to know when Rude Sprude finishes you, you were at your very best.
Piper finished off the Brawler with a back suplex. He's not sending any messages to All Japan. He's just sad because he can't use the sleeper because he handed that off to Brutus the Barber Beefcake at WrestleMania 3. And part of the deal was if Piper comes back, he can't reclaim his finishing hold. But he puts the Brawler's hat on to score the pinfall. And a reminder that the Survivor Series team is Roddy's Rowdies, not Rowdy's Roddies. I know that there's been some confusion about that. But all I ever think of, you know I said that, like, there's an inconclusive ending to the Piper and Rude feud. There's an obvious ending to it that satisfies me, at the very least. And that's that Piper, you have a hair match. And yeah, maybe you don't have Rude go out with, like, the sleeper or whatever if you want to keep him strong for the Warrior, but maybe have, like, some accident happen where, like, Rude gets his hair cut, or, like, he cuts off the back of the hair or something like that. Something to explain why all of a sudden he showed up with a short haircut, but without killing him dead for a world title program.
Here we go again. Last week on the Superstars of Wrestling, we witnessed the crowning of new World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions. Let's go back in time and relive history in the making.
It's already got referenced in the intro, but thinking back, I remember watching this match when it originally aired, and first of all thinking, huh, wow, they're having this match on television, which seemed very unusual because I did not understand the concept of the only real title changes that they would do on television would be tag team title changes. Traditionally, it would be done on the Saturday morning TV. That's why you see a lot of title changes in Allentown. And I was very confused looking it up in that, like, wrestling almanac that I must have had as a kid. And then just seeing that every tag team title change took place in Allentown for, like, a 5 or 6 year period. And not knowing that I would be doing a podcast someday called Greetings from Allentown. But here, of course, they're in Wheeling, West Virginia. And the title change kind of comes as a shock because, like I said, it's like in 5 minutes. But then again, you know, you don't have long matches back then. Like, even like 10 minutes would be a long television match because we're talking about a 1 hour program here. Now you can say, well, why do they have to have long matches today? Well, part of that is because you have a 3 hour Raw and even a 2 hour SmackDown, and you have to fill out the program every single week. It's not like in Superstars they could give somebody 23 minutes. That was not the kind of promotion that they were running. This is not NWA Worldwide where we're going to have Ronnie Garvin and Ric Flair basically take up the entirety of the show and other matches that were like that as well.
Now smash back in as well. Again, all four busters in there. And things don't look too good for the Brain Busters.
Referee's got to get some control, though. He's got to get some people out of that ring.
Blanchard being set up.
Yes, Vince said that Axe came off the top rope when clearly, to anybody who's watching it, he came off the middle rope. Better get some eyeglasses, pal. Anyway, that's about the fastest update segment of all time, because they go back to Gene, he's all like, how about that? And we get the quick cut, which is pretty common in this video. It's only 41 minutes. I was wondering what might be missing. There might have been an event center. I don't know, and I don't really care to look it up. But we now go to the genius Lanny Poffo standing in the ring, hickory dickory dock.
Mr. Perfect, Mr. Perfect, so appropriately named. I just think of Mr. Perfect all day long. It takes a real genius to appreciate perfection and pay tribute to a man who's never wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, the genius presents Mr. Perfect!
Well?
You know, McMahon,
what?
I know why you don't like the genius.
Why?
Because he graduated from Harvard and you never did.
I didn't go to Harvard.
You mean you lied to me all these years when you were giving me Bula Bula and all that?
This whole relationship between the genius and Mr. Perfect reminds me very much of Smithers and Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, and not just because you refer to him as Mr. Burns, Mr. Perfect, both guys being known as Mr. It's just a certain sort of, I don't know, supplicant sort of way that Lanny Poffo would approach this. And I guess I used the word supplicant, you know, by accident, because I remember Lord Alfred Hayes would refer to Lanny Poffo as supple on those MSG shows in 86. Now, Perfect is kind of like the link between Lanny and Randy Savage, because Perfect's paired up with the genius here, and then when he comes back at the Survivor Series in 92, who does Randy Savage ask to be his tag team partner? I know, that's a happy accident, and they really needed to scramble for that. By the way, Mr. Perfect is taking on Bill Woods. It was a very interesting cage match, not because he had any famous moments or anything, but because he would alternate between the name Bill Wood and Bill Woods without any discernible pattern whatsoever. I don't know. But what I thought was funny is before the match, you got Lanny Poffo in the ring with Wood, and I think you know what that means. There once was a man named Anus. Anyway, what a lovely job guy this Bill Wood Woods is. Because almost every one of those matches is on television. Like, I could not figure out any sort of pattern to what was going on. I also kind of looked up stuff about Lanny Poffo. Just interesting. He did not go to college from what I saw, because he was wrestling from the age of 20. And the whole mortarboard and that the whole genius gimmick kind of is a play off something that his father, Angelo Poffo, did in Detroit in the mid-70s in big-time wrestling, oddly enough, when he was teaming with his son, Lanny. I know a lot is made about how the genius signed with WCW when his brother went over there and then virtually never wrestled, save for, I guess, one stray appearance in a dark match on a Saturday night taping in 1997, which makes it even more hilarious, like how that was several years after he would have signed. But when you really think about it, okay, if he's part of a package deal to make Randy Savage happy, don't you think he's actually worth it at that point? It's like when Pedro Martinez was pitching for the Red Sox. He's one of the greatest pitchers of all time. But he even went to another level for a two-year period, 1999 and 2000. the 2 years in which his older brother and role model, Ramon Martinez, was with the Red Sox. Now, was Ramon a great pitcher? No, not anymore. He had some decent performances for the Red Sox. But he was certainly worth having around if he was going to make Pedro Martinez more comfortable, more happy, and all of that. Same with Lanny and his brother, Randy Savage. If it makes the Macho Man even better, then it's worth keeping Lanny around and, you know, just having him draw a paycheck. Anyway, this is a Mr. Perfect match, and I've spent like 5 minutes talking about Lanny Poffo, as I do, there's something about him. I don't know what it is. As Perfect didn't really have a program quite yet. He's still doing that thing where he's just winning matches, which, oh my God. I mean, what a concept that is. Or time limit draws on house shows. Talked about him and Bret Hart a while back. He's just kind of toying with Woods for the lockup, as there's an article in the World Wrestling Federation magazine involving Mr. Perfect and the Genius. But to my point about keeping Randy Savage happy and giving the Genius some sort of role, I'm willing to accept this pairing if it means you get the best possible, you know, performance out of Randy Savage on a nightly basis and he's happy, even if it means that Mr. Perfect is not with Bobby Heenan, and that would have been, well, a perfect pairing, quite honestly. Henning, Perfect, does that snap mare thing where he goes over the top, snaps the guy's neck as he's sitting on the canvas. And they do mention Hulk Hogan, finally. And that program's going to get rolling on the Saturday Night's Main Event later in the month, where Perfect destroys the first Winged Eagle belt. But it allows for more Vince and Jesse banter, because Mr. Perfect had famously done those vignettes about how good he was at all the various sports. And Kegleg was actually one of them. Yes, that's bowling, and it leads to this humorous exchange.
Whoever may be or makes a strike when he's bowling, he turns around and says, Hulk Hogan, you can't do that.
And he's probably right.
Well, does it really matter, though?
You ever gone bowling with Hogan?
No, I can't say that I have.
Well, then that tells you right there.
This is why Jesse Ventura is so great. His determination to bury Hulk Hogan is so strong that he's going to bring up the topic of bowling and insinuate that because Vince McMahon had never gone bowling with Hulk Hogan, that meant that Hogan was somehow an inferior bowler to Mr. Perfect. I mean, oh my God. And I'm pretty sure that Vince has gone bowling with Hogan. I mean, can't you just picture them, like, you know, snorting a line of cocaine, like the length of a bowling gutter while doing No Holds Barred? They went to the bowling alley to kind of unwind during the writing of that film. Anyway, we got a brief comeback from Woods. SD Jones Memorial charge into the corner, but Perfect gets the boots up. And then channels his inner John Cena from decades later by calling the Perfect Plex once again at the top of his lungs. Now you're going to see a Perfect Plex. And my suspicion, and he connects for the 1-2-3, obviously. My suspicion with Perfect as he's entering this Hulk Hogan feud, and this is really isn't a suspicion, it does seem to be what it was, is that the Widowmaker Barry Windham was primed for that spot, because they didn't have him lose at all, just like Mr. Perfect. They're talking about Perfect being the only guy with an undefeated record. Well, Windham is kind of on his way out. He's on a Survivor Series team, but he's going to be substituted for. And Mr. Perfect, obviously, with the undefeated record himself. Undefeated record. Oh, my God. There's the accent coming out. Must have been an Oktoberfest that I had just before recording here. But anyway, I think Perfect got the Windham spot.
All the Dream Team are is fools following a thief named Dusty Rhodes. A common man who's nothing but a common thief. Well, Honky Tonk Man's gonna play the hits on somebody's head. Bigger King's gonna splash somebody's guts out. Rick Martel's simply gonna outclass them all. And I'm gonna enforce the law to the fullest extent.
We had another awkward cut to an event center with Sean Mooney, but in this case, I'm actually glad that he's not plugging some event at MSG or the Boston Garden or what have you, because it's Survivor Series season, and that means you're just gonna have Survivor Series team promos aplenty. But what's strange is he mentions the Rude Brood, and then it cuts immediately to the Enforcers, a team made up of the Big Boss Man, Akeem, Honky Tonk Man, and Rick Martel, who's only now being called the Model, as I don't think he's with Slick anymore at this point. So the Rick Martel dance party is over. The Rick Martel modeling auditions have begun. It's very interesting how the boss man is the only one allowed to talk. I think something got cut out there. And Akeem doesn't actually end up on this team at the Survivor Series. I think he gets hurt or something because the Bad News Brown substitutes in, which I think was a terrible idea by the Honky Tonk Man to be like, hey, remember that guy who walked out on my team last year? Let's bring him in. And dang, yes, I did just mention the 1988 Survivor Series. I say because Akeem wrestles Dusty Rhodes on the primetime wrestling right before the Survivor Series. And I tweeted a picture of that with the Spider-Man meme with Spider-Man, you know, the two Spider-Men pointing at each other. Like, yeah, it's never been more appropriate than a Dusty Rhodes Akeem match. But I also tweeted out the screen cap of this interview. And I thought, once again, this just encapsulates wrestling in its purest form. You have the police officer, law enforcement officer, excuse me. I know he's a prison guard. You got Akeem, a guy wearing a giant yellow dashiki, which means that he's declining. I always talk about the Andre going from black to blue, but we never talk about Akeem going from blue to yellow. That signaled a decline as well. The Honky Tonk Man is there, and Martel with the towel around his neck in the middle. And say everybody complains about the occupational gimmicks of the mid-90s. Like, these guys are all occupational gimmicks. It's a prison guard, a model, a musician, and Akeem, let's just say he's a dancer. And I love the variety of it all. There's nothing better. Now, we get another team from the Survivor Series, the Ultimate Warriors, which a lot of great branding there. I think the Warrior team would be better the following year when you literally had four Warriors, Modern Day, Ultimate, and Road. But looking at this team, which is made up of, I'm sorry, I can't even stifle myself here. You got Ultimate Warrior, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, Shawn Michaels, and Marty Jannetty. Who the hell's the normal guy out of that group?
Bobby Heenan, can you survive? Bobby Heenan, can your family survive?
You know what happens every Thanksgiving? The turkeys start scrambling for their life because they know they're going to die. And we got four of them in the ring with us, and we're going to take care of them.
I'll tell you what, one by one, we're going to eliminate every member from the Heenan family, leaving 1 7-foot-4 giant for all of the Ultimate Warriors to take care of.
There is definitely a smell in the air. There is definitely a smell of combat. You, Andre the Giant, and the entire Heenan family will fall to the power!
I mean, these are four guys with some very distinct problems, although I guess Sean and Marty would be closer to each other in terms of the problems that they would have. Jannetty talking about murdering turkeys. It's like, maybe I should investigate him for what I found in my backyard, which, by the way, I can provide an update because I went back there to try and remove the carcass, and it was gone. So, once again, nature taking its course. So, who is the most normal guy out of this group? The answer is none of the above, or I don't know. But ask myself another question. Like, I always like looking at Survivor Series teams and ranking, like, who I would most want to hang out with out of all those guys. I mean, sometimes it can be tough. Like that Jake Roberts and Hacksaw Jim Duggan team from the 88 Survivor Series. Like, where do I rank Scott Casey in all of that? Like, I have absolutely no idea. But here, for hanging out with these guys, I got to go number one, Anvil, because I think he would be a blast. You never know what would be happening next. But you also know that he would have your back because he's a loyal family man. Number two, I would actually go with the Ultimate Warrior because while I'm not a fan of, well, either the wrestler or really his belief system, I think he's probably pretty low-key. Because he brings it all out on camera. So, like, behind the scenes, you can have just, like, nice quiet night, you know, just sipping a glass of wine. I don't know if he drank wine. So that leaves us to Sean and Marty. Who would I rather hang out with? And the answer is, despite my distaste for Shawn Michaels, I have to go with him. Because if you hang out with Marty, there's better than 50-50 chance you're going to be found to be an accessory to something.
One morning in June, some 20 years ago. But freedom, I have none. I've been looking for freedom.
just 2 days before this show aired, the Berlin Wall came down. What a remarkable thing that was for the cause of freedom in the world. Doesn't it feel like a million years away, even though it was only 31 years ago? Feels like a lot of that stuff has sort of been reversed, but glad we had David Hasselhoff on hand to let us know. It provided freedom for millions of East Germans and other nationalities east of the Iron Curtain. However, it did not provide freedom from having to talk about the Bushwhackers matches on Superstars. They're taking on Bob Emery and Craig Brown, and as Jesse calls them, the marching morons. And I would love to have freedom from talking about these guys, because this is another act like Hacksaw Jim Duggan where I've pretty much said everything I can say. I mean, with Duggan, I usually find a way, but with the Bushwhackers, it's like, I understand they're a comedy act, and I can appreciate that. It's not going to speak to me, but for God's sakes, what else can I say about it? However, I am glad that this is a Vince and Jesse Superstars, because the banter of these two, given Jesse's distaste for these guys and Vince, you know, you'll get a Vince laugh out of him, like as if they were hillbillies, but they're not hillbillies. They're like New Zealand version of hillbillies. So Vince asks Jesse a very earnest question about the Bushwhackers.
Now, Jesse, let me ask you, what sort of strategy do you think the Bushwhackers have in preparation for this matchup?
What?
For once, I have no idea what these two use for strategy. What do you think? I hang out with them? You think I interview them? I stay as far away from them as I possibly can, McMahon.
Why? Just because of the sardine breath? They're not bad guys, Jesse.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You go out to dinner with them and stuff?
I haven't had that pleasure, no.
Pleasure?
I mean,
I call it more torture.
They're a little on the eccentric side, that's for sure.
And this is definitely a thing where, even as a kid, I lined up on Team Jesse on this one. Now, while I didn't agree with him and his views about Hulk Hogan, I did find it humorous how he would go out of his way to take cheap shots at him. Bushwhackers do get an inset promo where they use the term rowdies roddies, so I warned you about that. It's the usual offense, and they follow up with the battering ram and the gut buster. But the important thing is that we get more high-quality, 4.5-star, let's say, Vince and Jesse banter.
I'm speechless, McMahon. What do you say about these two?
Well, all I'd like to say is they're cousins. Would you like to meet the rest of the family?
I hear they're the normal ones, too.
Luke and Butcher.
Yeah. They're the ones that they let out of New Zealand.
Wow. You go over to New Zealand and do an in-depth report, one of those Jesse the Body on locations kind of thing.
I think I'll pass on that one.
There's nothing I can really say about that. I'm with Jesse. Other than the stuff that I said before, they come over and they don't have to work as hard because they don't have to do this crazy brawling style like when they were the sheepherders. So it's basically more money and less work, which, as I've always said, is the American dream. And again, I think I made that same point about Hacksaw Jim Duggan. So we get another weird cut in this video where I feel like something got left out, and we go right to the next bout, which is the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, taking on Trent Knight. And with fall having just arrived, I think today as I'm taping this is the equinox, which I learned that the way the sun comes across is not necessarily inverted on the two equinoxes, equinoxes. That sounds more correct. Anyway, I don't know too much about that, but what I do know is that Ted DiBiase's fall residence is in Bel Air, California. By the way, the house in Madison, Mississippi has still not sold yet, and they haven't done a price change. So I don't know what the hell's going on with that. It's been on the market now for almost 4 months for $1.575 million. It's like, do you want to sell the house or not? Okay, because the government is probably going to take it if, you know, when you lose that case or when you plea bargain or whatever. So I don't know. I'm left scratching my head, but Vince and Jesse have a rather fun discussion. Now remember, this is before the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you know, really raised that particular location in the public consciousness. They have an interesting conversation about that particular neighborhood of Los Angeles.
making his autumn residence in Bel Air, California. Weighing 260 pounds, here is the self-proclaimed million-dollar champion, Ted DiBiase.
There's two gates to get into Bel Air. Do you know that? There's the east gate and the west gate.
From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
You gotta say the gate to let you in, the gate to let you out.
No, there's two entrances. Right. Obviously, you never have been to Bel Air, have you, McMahon? I've been there.
Well, what's so special about Bel Air?
My buddy Marvin Davis lives there. He's got a little tiny cottage up in the hills.
There is indeed an East Gate and a West Gate in Bel Air, but there's actually three subdivided neighborhoods that are distinct from each other. West Gate Bel Air, East Gate Old Bel Air, and then Upper Bel Air. I don't know which one that the family lived in the Fresh Prince of Bel Air, but... That's a show that if it found its way onto Netflix, I would certainly watch all the way through. Maybe that's one of the ones I should check Amazon Prime for. Now watch. Somebody's gonna reach out to me and be like, it's on Hulu, you dumbass. And I'm gonna be like, no, I don't have Hulu. You know why? Because I cut myself off. I can only have so many freaking streaming services. And I barely even watch the WWE Network, the award-winning WWE Network at this point. Because most of the stuff for the show I can watch elsewhere, and I'm disgusted by the fact that, oh yeah, we're going to post 10 episodes of Velocity, as if anybody gives a shit about that. Anyway, DiBiase starts out with two takedowns, a fireman's carry takedown and an arm drag, as Jesse actually makes a point that I found to be very incorrect, saying that money can't buy ability. And I'm like, yes it can. I mean, you think about, like, rich kids taking karate lessons. Like, all those Cobra Kai kids, like, they all lived up in the hills. They were all rich. So they went to the school, and they were able to get ability. Now, of course, Daniel turned out to be better than them. Yeah, he squeezed in some Karate Kid 2. A Karate Kid talk. Not Karate Kid 2 talk. I'll cram that in at a different time. What I'm saying is, money can buy ability because you can find a teacher. Let me just put it this way. At the end of the day, every teacher has his or her price. Just think about that woman in Groundhog Day who teaches the piano to that kid, and when Bill Murray comes in with all the money that he stole from the Brinks truck, or armored truck, or whatever the hell brand it was, she basically tells the kid to go screw because she has the opportunity to make more money. That's the exact example that I'm talking about. Bill Murray uses his money in order to become a good piano player in order to... you know, work his way up into, find his way out of February 2nd, I guess. Crowd is kind of dead for this. I would imagine it's probably late in the taping. This is like the 34th match that these people have seen. There's a murmur for the 7 out of 10 Sawyer DiBiase power slam. That's where my ranking is. Million Dollar Dream finishes. And out of nowhere, the Powers of Pain and Zeus are along to congratulate DiBiase. And there's nobody there that's any more money than Zeus, considering all the excitement that he brings whenever he's around. It's part of that DiBiase Savage timeshare that I've talked about a million times. And they were certainly a well-protected group at the Survivor Series because, yeah, DiBiase eats the pin at the end, but Powers of Pain get disqualified at the same time for spike pile-driving Hogan, which kind of interesting with the Brainbusters on their way out that the Powers of Pain were using that move. And then Zeus tries to break Hogan's neck with that weird vice thing, and he gets disqualified as well, which allows Jesse to throw an absolute nutty on commentary about how Hogan has the referees in his back pocket.
Well, the Powers of Pain, well, at least the pain is going to be passed out in the Survivor Series. Let's hear now from all of the Hulkamaniacs.
I know on one of the following shows leading up to the Survivor Series, they would either be on the Brother Love show or they'd get a platform interview together. But here they're just in the back. And they rank fairly high, this Hulkamaniacs team, which is Hulk Hogan, Demolition, and Jake the Snake Roberts. So the tag team champions, the world champion, and Jake the Snake, a classic example of a guy who never needed a belt because he was so good at everything else, other than maybe putting on a classic five-star match, as some people prefer. But it's very interesting, the dynamic of this team, because clearly Hogan is the alpha. And then you get Axe there, and all I can ever think about, because I'm a weirdo, is, oh yeah, the Masked Superstar challenged Hogan for the belt in 84.
This is just like
what we were talking about. Everybody sets their goals high, and look what happens. This isn't just ours. This is everybody's. This is everybody's. This is what you need, Ted DiBiase. You need a little bit of family. That's what we are. When we get together, we kick people's teeth together.
This is not the $1 million belt. This is the Hulkamaniac belt. This is not purchased. These belts, this Hulkamaniac team can't be bought. You gotta fight, kick, and grind for it. And Hulk Hogan, we are gonna fight, kick, and grind for you all the way.
You know something, multi-$1 million man? Now that we're winding down to the Survivor Series, now that it's not that far off, I really like the fact that you're being backed into a corner by your own team. These guys aren't a bunch of has-beens like you tried to drill into the Powers of Pain's mind. These are the best in the world, brother. These are the best at what they do. These are the WWF Tag Team Champions, number one. I'm glad you had to cut an extra check to the Powers of Pain. And as far as Jake the Snake's DDT stretcher service, arenas all around the country, multi-$1 million man, his opponents are getting that long, slow ride in that rolling coffin. As the ambulance wheels out of the arenas, as the red lights come on, I can't help but think you're going to be the next victim of the DDT. Zeus, you're mine. Jake the Snake, how are you going to get him in the DDT?
Bottom line is this, my man. A man is dying of thirst has to have water. A dog that's starving has to have food. A child that's crying has got to have some attention. I have got to have you, Ted DiBiase.
You know, we all have our needs. We all have our wants. But one thing I know, multi-$1 million man, winding down into this thing, you're going to be on the phone. You're going to try to get a hold of Jake the Snake. You're going to try to get a hold of Demolition. Nobody here sells out. We live by the commandments.
I love this version of Hogan who puts over his pals in the most earnest fashion. And there's no lame wads there like your hillbilly Jims or your tugboats. No offense to hillbilly Jim or anything, but, you know, they're just not in the same league as Demolition and Jake the Snake Roberts. And I don't even need to explain why that's the case. But what I'm fascinated by is on the week that the Iron Curtain falls in Eastern Europe, we get this revelation that now all of a sudden Demolition is some sort of socialist or dare I say communist organization. The tag team belts are now the property of the community as a whole. That just seems very strange to me. I would not have taken these Mad Max characters. I probably would have seen them as true libertarians, even though libertarianism kind of falls apart in a public health crisis. But I've already explained that. But yeah, I did not take them for being a sort of socialist thing. Or maybe it's just one of those things that you say. Like Iceman Parsons last week saying, I'm pals with the Von Erichs. Like a thing you say when you come into world class. Here it's like, all right, yeah, I'm on this Survivor Series team. And by the way, Survivor Series was never kind to Demolition. Certainly one of the greatest tag teams in WWF history, but their history in the Survivor Series is certainly checkered. Like in 87, I think they get disqualified, but you don't remember anything they did in the match, which kind of encapsulates their entire 1987, at least other than the theme song, which they got later in the year. 88, you have the weird double turn with Fuji and the Warlord, Barbarian, and all that business. And here, 89 starts to be the year where guys are losing via like simple clotheslines. It's like, Demolition seems to be getting pinned awfully quickly in this match. And you're left scratching your head. And of course, 1990, you got all three of them out there. And Axe could not give a shit less. But yeah, more of this Hogan, where he's like Guy Fieri with less hair, but with only half the charisma.
Well, you know what's unique about Snuka's team in the Survivor Series? Yeah. We all know that the Bushwhackers will eat anything on this earth, right?
Yeah, I think that's pretty safe to say.
So will this guy. You know,
that's true too.
His ancestry is not a proud thing, you know, McMahon.
What do you mean? I would beg to differ with that. What do you mean not proud? He's about one of the proudest individuals you'll ever meet is Superfly Jimmy Snuka. We spoke to him earlier on, as a matter of fact.
I am proud and happy to be partners with Roddy Piper and the Bushwhackers, and we're going to survive.
It's unclear to me what diet has to do with an effective Survivor Series team. Piper, Snuka, and the Bushwhackers, which is an interesting enough pairing, but I'll get into that in a second. By the way, the match here is Jimmy Snuka against Tony Burton, and it's really not a whole hell of a lot. I mean, it's a headbutt, a slam, and the superfly splash off the top. But obviously, the topic that I have to bring up, the elephant in the room at the time was, having watched Coliseum tapes and being aware of what was going on, or any fan who, you know, had been watching since 1984 remembers Roddy Piper hitting Jimmy Snuka with a coconut. And they have a blood feud, 84, all the way into 85, pretty much up to the point where Snuka leaves. So to see these two guys teaming together, even if it's almost over three years after Piper's face turn, it's still very, very strange. To the point where some of these late 80s Survivor Series teams, you would get some interesting combinations. Kind of like certain like rap trios where it would just be like three dudes together and like, how did they decide to collaborate on this? Well, I can't answer that because I don't really know as much about rap music, but it's an interesting question for what was the strangest pairing of two people in, let's say 87 to 89 Survivor Series. Because Snuka and Piper definitely ranks up there for that. And I'm not talking about, like, Hillbilly Jim and Coco Beware and Red Rooster being in the main event of Survivor Series 88. Ding. I'm talking about guys who were in a blood feud not that long before now all of a sudden they're teammates. 87, it seems like they lost their bleeping minds when it came to any sort of continuity going on. Because in that one, you had Paul Orndorff teaming up with Hulk Hogan. Now, granted, there was, you know, a bit of time there, about 8-9 months since that program had pretty much wound down. But earlier on in that show, you saw Ricky Steamboat teaming with not only Randy Savage, who he was feuding with up pretty much to the point where he lost the title because they're having rematches and steel cage matches around the country. He had Steamboat and Jake the Snake. I mean, it's pretty remarkable when you think about it. It's like these guys were sworn enemies and now all of a sudden they're teammates in the Survivor Series. But I think that, to me, is one of the appeals of the Survivor Series, at least during that era, when it's just that these guys who, oh, I never thought I would see these guys paired together. Now, not to complain about modern product, but you turn it on now and T-Bone is, I'm sorry, did I get the guy's name from Retribution wrong? I don't even know what the hell he wants to be called. I remember when I had high hopes for Dijak, but apparently that went out the window a while ago. Anyway, late 80s Survivor Series teams, certainly one of my favorite topics. I could probably talk about this for 3 hours, I think. Like, Scott Casey teaming with Jake the Snake. When did you think you would ever see that, huh?
Look at that jewelry.
Boy, he said a mouthful.
And there are even fewer men in the WWF who Axe and Smash have ever had to look up to. However, my guests this week are certainly rougher. Without a doubt, are tougher. And indeed, Brothers Demolition, you will look up to the eighth wonder of the world, Andre the Giant and Haku. Welcome,
indeed.
Brother Brian. Yeah.
A colossal connection.
Got to admit, I was proud of Pritchard for using the grammatically correct Brothers Axe and Smash, but then he said Brother Demolition as if it was a singular unit. It would actually be Brothers Demolition. It's that whole Attorneys General thing. So, man, did they move on fast from the Braid Busters? Literally on this tape, it's like, all right, we're giving our notice. All right, okay, you're going to drop the titles tonight, and then we're also going to tape a segment with Andre and Haku on the Brother Love Show. which interesting to me that they had this plan to move on to so fast, almost like they had it in their back pocket all along. I don't know if Pritchard has ever addressed this or ever brought up on any of those shows, but, you know, Arn and Tully are still there to the Survivor Series, and you're already going to work in Heenan's new team, almost as if Arn and Tully were going to keep the belts all the way to WrestleMania 6, which seems like it would have been the logical plan rather than them losing it suddenly on Superstars, you know, the week before this. But now, okay, we're going to trot out the new Heenan tag team where it's Andre coming off a series of losses to the Ultimate Warrior in under 30 seconds, mainly. Maybe that was to save his body for this one last little run. Then again, there's probably nothing left to save because Andre's in blue. Again, very, very sad. Of course, he's not as tall as he used to be either at this point. But they're doing the thing where when they get out to the set, you have to do this every single time, is Andre stands in front. That way, on the camera, he looks that much taller than everybody else there. And I can understand that.
Baby X and Smash Demolition are walking around right now with the Tag Team Championship of the World Wrestling Federation, which belongs to the Heenan family. But I'm going to guarantee you something. The titles are coming back, and they're coming back to where they belong, because with over 800 pounds, over 7 feet 5, and this man's ability, there's no way, no way that I can't lose.
There we go again with the Jimmy Garvin problem from last week. No way I can't lose. Yet another double negative. Heenan, maybe it's a tacit acknowledgement that he's in the babyface territory and that he is bound to lose at the end. Before I play the next clip, I do have to give a warning specific to one person out there. And I'm talking to you, Keithy, voice of Greetings from Allentown and co-host, guest, whatever, on GFA Live. Haku is going to speak here, so I want you to sit down, strap yourself in, maybe strap yourself in two different ways, maybe even put on a straight jacket if you're feeling a little cold. Oh, my God. Oh, it's the greatest comedy duo of the late 1980s. I have no idea what Haku said, and I'm not going to begrudge him his choice to speak in whatever language that he wants to. Haku, as the one true king, is allowed to do whatever he wants. Of course, Andre, just because of his sheer size, is also allowed to do whatever the hell he wants to.
And I will tell you something. Demolition, we will see who's going to be demolished.
Too sure what he said.
Because right now, put in and put the best team in the world ever. At Demolition, you may be stop. You may be tough guys. You show that to everybody. But show that to her. Tell us how strong you are. We love to hear you.
I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is the greatest episode of the Brother Love Show that ever aired. However, this might be qualified as a hidden gem because you get Haku talking in his native tongue. You get Vince and Jesse at each other's throats. Andre just yelling a bunch of crap, trash talking. And we get a grammar lesson from Brother Love and Heenan with regard to double negatives and brother's demolition. I mean, what the hell? I don't know what else I could have wanted from this. I mean, yeah, I know it's not as consequential as Earthquake squashing Hogan or Boss Man beating the crap out of Hogan or even when Piper had mouthwash spit in his face by Rick Rude. By the way, not a very COVID-friendly angle that. But I don't know. If somebody were to ask me, what's your favorite Brother Love segment that nobody remembers? I would say either this or the one with Dusty that I covered a few while back where Dusty says he doesn't do hard time.
10 teams, 4 men on each team attempt to decimate their opponents until all members of a team are eliminated.
That's the name of the game.
I always talk about I gotta watch Terry Funk if I'm down on wrestling or this or that, when really it's all about November WWF shows with Survivor Series team promos. This is the Survivor Series report, and this is my bread and butter. This is what I love. These random teams coming together for these sometimes crazy promos. Teams of five strive to... Oh, wait. No, it's not teams of five anymore. It's teams of four fighting for more. I have no freaking idea. So instead of four matches with five guys on a side and with the tag team match that I liked, but a lot of people don't. I don't understand how you could not like that 20-man tag from Survivor Series 88. There's got to be something wrong with you cognitively, and you have to get a functional MRI, or I recommend that. You can make this your referral. I think it might, if you get a referral for that from a wrestling podcaster, I do think that counts. So now you got the tag teams mixed up with the singles guys, which is the worst thing that could have happened to the tag teams, because you get that demolition thing, like I was saying earlier, where they look like complete pussies compared, for lack of a better term here, compared to like Hogan and Jake. So Gene explains the permutations. Oh, it could be 4-on-3, 3-on-1, 4-1. Like, yeah, we get the math, Gene. We know how an elimination match works. We've been doing them for a couple of years now. So we get another team, like the one we saw earlier, the Enforcers, that didn't end up happening in the form of the King's Court, where you have former tag team partners Greg the Hammer Valentine and Dino Bravo, Dream Team 2, with the Macho King Randy Savage, because he only won the crown not long before this, so he's got that crown that came with the Hasbro figure that he would actually phase out rather quickly. Just like the crown's memorable because it was different from everything else, and it came with the Hasbro figure. And the Widowmaker, Barry Windham, who is standing in the background there, he wouldn't make the Survivor Series because he would leave because of, well, various issues, such as his family getting caught busting counterfeiting. Once again, the fan in me kicks in where I'm watching all these guys together, and I'm scratching my head like, why isn't this guy holding a grudge about something that happened more than 4 years ago?
Deceptive practices, you guys are guilty of fighting out of your league. The king in his court. Ooh, are we ready? Hammer, tell everybody what's happening now.
The 4x4 is the name of that team. That just sums up the mentality. They're no match for the king's court.
Speaking of match, first time that we met, the odds were a little in their favor, but things are going to change, gentlemen, because we never lose.
I like it. Yeah, that was good. I like
right.
it.
Right. Right.
Dino Bravo, the world's strongest man. Hexel Jim Duggan, I feel sorry for your clowns that you call yourselves the 4x4s, because dissension doesn't even matter. We're better than you are. Survivor Series, we're the best.
Kind of weird how the Macho King uses the word guilty right in front of Barry Windham. I guess using the word plea bargain might have been a little strange in that spot. It's weird seeing Barry Windham playing grab ass with Greg Valentine. It's like, oh, you've now forgiven him for having a lit cigar rubbed in your eye, costing you the tag team titles back in 85? I know, I'd be pissed off about that for a little bit more than 4 years. I don't know, does that even count in this universe? Is he even Barry Windham anymore? Or is he somebody else? Maybe it's Dan Spivey dressed up as Barry Windham again. That would have been funny if they had brought back Dan Spivey and just called him, like, the Widowmaker and just pretended that, like, nothing was amiss. So their opponents are the 4x4s, as they're talking about. It's Bret the Hitman Hart, Roddy Garvin, so a once-in-future world champion, and Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Hercules. And these guys, they are working a bit.
I don't know.
Eskimo pussy is mighty cold.
Eskimo pussy is mighty cold.
Feels good.
Oops, sorry, I think I pulled the wrong clip there.
I don't know, but I've been told 4x4s are mighty bold. Team Kurt, huh? King's Court,
Take a look at these four men, because we've got something to say. Survival of the fittest, and Black Widow, I'm the hitman looking for you.
And Greg Hammer Valentine, I'm going to be gunning for you.
And remember, Savage, with all that action going on, you're not going to be able to know where I am every moment. And I'm going to get my hands on you.
And Dino Bravo, you're going to find out what it means that only the strong survive in the Survivor Series.
Teamwork, team precision, team sacrifice. That's what it's about. We've got Garvin, we've got Hercules, we've got the Hitman, and we've got Hacksaw, and we've got Wood, and we're coming for you, tough guy. Ho!
All right, I broke that down like the Zapruder film, frame by frame, when Duggan says they've got Wood, just to see if anybody's face cracked, whether it be Garvin, Brett, or Hercules. Nobody cracked. I thought I caught Hercules smiling a bit, but no, apparently not. How the hell did they not all crack up laughing when he said that? Of course, you know that he said that for a reason. I mean, it was probably to pop Vince, who's probably just standing right there. So I'm wondering, did any of these matches happen, like, exactly how it was laid out? I'm thinking that the only one that did was the DiBiase team against Hogan's team. And that was pretty much how it was going in and actually stayed that way all the way through. But, like, you know, Tully Blanchard, he's out. Hakeem, he gets subbed out. Oh, I almost called him Hakeem. Like, no. Olajuwon changed his name because Hakeem stole his name and he didn't want to be associated with it. And then, of course, there is the Dream Team with Brutus Beefcake. But not that Dream Team, because Valentine's on a completely different team. We got Dusty Rhodes as the team captain. Because we only have one team captain this year because there's only four guys. Which means Beefcake's now relegated to number two guy with Tito in the third slot. And the Red Rooster, bringing up the rear, God almighty. The fact that Terry Taylor has to team with Dusty Rhodes here, and Dusty and Terry Taylor were not exactly the greatest of pals during this time. Apparently, Terry Taylor kind of left the NWA because he was caught mocking Dusty Rhodes at a certain point. But here they are on the same Survivor Series team that, if you take out Beefcake, it's one hell of a babyface team circa 1985.
How about it, brothers? We're going to carve up some turkeys on Thanksgiving night.
That's right, baby. The Dream Team. We've got our game plan ready to get rid of four big turkeys. Yeah, baby.
All right. The Fox starts here with the Dream Team. We are going to take it to the enforcers and take care of business. What do you think, Dream?
I see what the Dream Team is ready. My main man, the Beefcake, will be doing some jumping quicker than Green Lantern and the Rooster and the Dream. The enforcers are going to feel American justice. As the Survivor Series, we're going to take care of business. The Dream Team! The Dream Team! Dream Team! Dream Team!
Lest you think that it's a new low for Terry Taylor with that promo, he does have a sweet Survivor Series shirt on. I mean, maybe it's not as good as the Ringer shirts from 1988, but still pretty sweet to the point where I'm sure some collector out there would pay upwards of, and including, $100 for that very shirt. I don't know if any of them even still exist, but I gotta say, Beefcake had to feel weird during this, chanting, Dream Team, Dream Team. It's like a guy who was playing in the CFL at the time, and he's playing for the Ottawa Rough Riders, and then, you know, maybe he plays for the Hamilton Tiger Cats for a couple of years, and then he goes and finishes out his career with the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. So he was playing, he's a former Rough Rider playing for the Rough Riders. That's Beefcake right here. I don't know why I felt compelled to make a CFL reference, but that's how it goes. And we don't get a Rude Brood promo. I don't know if it's another one of those weird cuts, but I would have loved to have heard from that entire team. We are going to hear from Rude a little bit later on, but yeah, I like that team too. Certainly underrated when you think of those late 80s Survivor Series teams. You get the two Minnesota boys, Rude and Henning, childhood friends, if I remember correctly. But there was a certain bond between those two guys because they came from the same place, along with the Rougeau brothers. So the Minnesota boys and the All-American boys. And I'm kind of sad. I would have, you know, I think I got like a half dozen of these team promos during the show, and somehow I feel unfulfilled. There's 10 teams. I wanted to hear from all 10 teams. Am I going to have to do another November of 89 show? Probably not for a little while, because there are other Survivor Series years. I mean, God knows there's a couple of weeks from November of 91 that I haven't covered yet. I mean, maybe I could get a promo with that Big Bully Busick team that existed very briefly. And you're going to talk about teams that never ended up happening. I mean, that's the class example. But yeah, 89 Survivor Series, for whatever reason, I don't remember it as fondly as some of the other shows. And I think I have a theory for that. Survivor Series 88 I watched over and over again. You know that by now, just from listening to me for 20 minutes. But Survivor Series 89, I think what happened was I got the original pay-per-view, taped it, and then I think I lost the tape somewhere because I don't remember watching it as much, and I think that that has to be the reason. And my hope is that one of these times cleaning out my mother's house, I will come across that tape, even though it's completely worthless because it's digitized on the award-winning WWE Network.
Well, he is unquestionably one of the stronger individuals in the world. Whether or not he is actually the strongest man is so he claims. I have my doubts, Jesse.
Well, your doubts may be satisfied in just a few seconds, McMahon. Just minutes away. Just minutes away. I know how strong this guy was. I've seen him up close. I've trained with him.
The way the segments were arranged for the show seemed a little bit strange to me in that all of the matches seemed to be in the first half of the program, and then you have your Brother Love show, your Survivor Series report, and now you have this, the Feats of Strength. I don't think it's Festivus, but we get the Feats of Strength with Dino Bravo, which I suppose you put at the end because you figure, well, if it's going to cause people to tune out, you better to tack it on at the end and have them watch the whole beginning of the show. So Dino Bravo is going to do some push-ups, which sounds completely horrible. It's another interminable Dino Bravo strength segment. But then again, that's exactly what got me into wrestling. The first segment I ever watched was the Dino Bravo weightlifting segment at the 88 Royal Rumble, which I have to say, though, it's probably the same for a lot of people since that segment went on for approximately 3.5 weeks. So a lot of people probably tuned in around that time and saw wrestling, but I would imagine that not many of them, like me, stuck around. So I don't know. This is a very famous segment for reasons that we're going to get to in a little bit. But maybe, you know, you just say Dino Bravo Feats of Strength segment. It's like, okay, whatever. You're rolling your eyes in the back of your head. This is late 89 Dino Bravo where the milk has turned sour. But maybe Jimmy Hart, who, praise be to God, is there and not Frenchie Martin. Maybe Jimmy can sell this whole thing and make it seem cool.
Well, first of all, let him warm up just a little bit. And then Jimmy Hart, that's right, baby, is going to get on Dino Bravo's back. And he's going to do about 10, maybe 15 push-ups with a out, baby.
I don't know. Jimmy Hart, I love you and all, but as the kids say on Twitter these days, this ain't it. The kids do say that, right? I think I've seen that one place or not. But anyway, I'm not fond of seeing what Dino Bravo looks like during missionary sex because he's just doing push-ups in the ring like that, and I really don't need to see that. I did not need to envision it. Even if I was gay and liked muscle dudes, I'd be like, all right, enough with this guy. I mean, can we find somebody else, please? I mean, God almighty, enough with the Dino Bravo stuff. He's been there for 3 years now. It's like, oh, the never-ending push because of some sort of weird Montreal pixie dust or something. So now Jimmy gets on his back, which adds a little bit of kink to the proceedings, but it's not impressive because Jimmy Hart weighs approximately 38 pounds. Well, they say 120 or something like that.
Look at this, McMahon.
You can't weigh more than 120 pounds soaking wet.
Yeah, but he's got at least 50 pounds
of
money on
him.
I've never really given much thought to how much coins weigh. I think of more like the size of them and how the Susan B. Anthony dollar failed because it was too similar to the size of a quarter. And, like, how much does a quarter weigh relative to a dime? Like, 50 pounds of change. How much would that be? And as it turns out, a pound of dimes and a pound of quarters are both $20. They both come out to $20. And for some reason, that kind of amazes me. It's almost like the U.S. Mint planned that out. So yeah, this segment's dragging on for a while, and we're all like Milhouse watching the TV.
When are they gonna get to the fireworks factory?
Don't worry, Milhouse. It's only a couple of more trips over the horizon. As Bravo is kind of looking around, you can actually see over his shoulder. Now, this might be an accidental great framing job. A very large man sitting on the aisle, probably about halfway up of what they call a TD Garden, the loge section, the lower level, conveniently sitting on the aisle, I might add, so that he would stand out a little bit more, wearing a bright, but not too bright, shirt. You know, just kind of like maybe a ratty polo, is what I would say. The one with the little crocodile on it, I can't remember what the hell those were called.
You know, I guess we're going to have to prove to you that he is the world's strongest man, and I guess everybody out here too. Dino Bravo just told me that I can pick the largest man, the biggest man in the audience right now, and bring him into the ring, and he can get on Dino Bravo's back, and he'll do the push-ups with him, Mean Gene.
All right, take your pick, Jimmy.
Hey, listen,
Let's
Jesse.
See, what do you got over here?
They grow them pretty big in West Virginia, I can tell you that.
Excuse me, Jimmy Hart.
Well, Hart will find one. If there's anybody big to be found, Jimmy Hart will find them.
Okay, well, there's some big men in this audience this week.
There's
some big fat women out there.
You see somebody?
What's beautiful about this is that all of the fans sitting around John Tenta, the man on the aisle, are pointing to him immediately. He's got a big smile on his face because he knows that he's probably the biggest dude in there in terms of weight, although Vince said that they do grow him large in West Virginia. Good thing there wasn't like a 500-pound guy who was even bigger, but hey, you know, this is, when it comes to carny bullshit, this is the carniest, and it is beautifully executed in this case. But John Tenta, as nice a guy as you'd ever find, according to all accounts, who probably, you know, glad-handed everybody. You know, he knows a little bit about the wrestling business, probably not, you know, going to let on that, you know, he was a wrestler. But everybody around him seemed to, why else would they have pointed to him? Would they have told people to point to him? No. He sticks out like a sore thumb because they're looking for the biggest guy possible, which is why it works so great. And like I said, he was probably nice to everybody. So they're like, hey, pick my buddy who was talking to me earlier. You know, the jolly fat guy back here.
Oh, hey, Jesse, take a look at the size
of
this
man. That's impressive, Dino Bravo.
He does look pretty
come
big,
on down.
I got to see him when he
this
gets in the ring, man. Then we'll get a little more perspective. I mean,
maybe
he may only be 4 foot 11.
For Canadian strongman, Dino Bravo.
He is the world's strongest man. And like I said, baby, anybody in the audience, the people wanted this guy. Let's bring him down, man.
Ooh, he does look
we
pretty
see some
big.
Very good sized gentlemen of the World
everybody.
Wrestling Federation. Sir,
yeah,
come on
good,
up over here, if you would, please.
Him, huh? Sir? Yeah, just a big old mountain
come
boy.
Come on up and join us. I don't know exactly what you've got in mind, Tito Bravo. Sir?
Wow, he is big. Jesse.
Sir, come on in.
He looks like he's over 300
what's your
pounds.
Name?
That's, whoa.
John.
Your name is John. I assume you're from West Virginia.
Yes, sir.
Yeah?
Yeah, he talks like West Virginia.
Run around here.
Another one of the things that's so great about this, Tenta, he's all smiles, but there's a certain charming awkwardness to the way he's carrying himself. He didn't betray that he has a Canadian accent of any kind. I wouldn't say that he showed off a West Virginia accent, but if John Tenta, who, by the way, is 26 years old when this is taking place. Yes, 26 years old. If he had learned a West Virginia accent just for the purposes of the few words that he would say into that microphone, just for this angle, in order to build credibility, I would have to go ahead and build several churches in his honor. I would have absolutely no choice in the matter. I would have to do that. But this is why John Tenta is an all-time legend. He is rescuing us from the clutches of an interminable Dino Bravo segment.
John, do I dare ask how much you weigh?
How much does that guy weigh?
460 pounds.
Wait a minute. 460
Bravo,
pounds?
Bravo.
Yes, sir.
All right, Jimmy Hart, Dino Bravo.
This is one time when Jimmy Hart's mouth has really gotten Bravo into trouble. Big trouble.
Why do you say that, McMahon?
Hey, come on. You don't put somebody that's 460 pounds on your back and do a push-up.
Bravo's gonna.
No, he's not either.
Watch.
Man's got some size. Bravo down on the mat.
What a big mistake. Jimmy Hart is going to make a fool out of Dino Bravo.
Have a seat.
Bravo. Wow. 460 pounds getting on the back of Dino Bravo. That's plus Bravo's weight of, what's Dino he weigh, 270, 260?
Let's see if you can do a push-up. Let's see if you can do a push-up.
He's waving him off.
Get him back.
He's waving him off right away.
Okay, wait a minute. What is going on here?
He's got to stretch the back out a little bit.
Jimmy Hart, I need action.
Yeah, I guess so.
He's got to get ready. Just give him a second here.
So Bravo begs off when Tenta first sits on his back. I got to stretch it out. But please keep in mind we're at minute 6 of this segment by now. And by the way, the Ultimate Warrior is supposed to be there, I think, or at least that's the way I remembered it. And he's not there yet at this point. So it's just Dino Bravo out in the ring with Jimmy Hart and Mean Gene Okerlund. I mean, what the hell is it with Dino Bravo segments just running interminably long? But thankfully, again, John Tenta is there to save us, even though, just like the bench press thing, I have some questions about the legitimacy of the feat of strength here.
Ladies and
I know what Bravo was doing. He was just getting a feel of the amount of weight, you know.
You think so?
Bravo. Yeah. Down yeah. on the mat.
Well, he is thick and he is strong.
The crawl position.
See, now he's measuring off. He's getting his arms in the right position.
He's asked for this big man from West Virginia, John, to sit on his back. We're going to see if he can do a push-up. One, two, three.
I'm impressed.
You better be.
I'll tell you what, that was some feat of strength on the part of Dino Bravo.
It's kind of fascinating Vince's reaction to this, because when the bench press thing happened at the 88 Rumble, which Vince was on commentary for because Gorilla was out with one of his ailments, immediately questioned the legitimacy of it. And it's still being brought up. But here, you can clearly see the Tenta's feet are on the mat for the entire time that he does the push-ups. Now, Jimmy Hart, they didn't do it the same way. Now, obviously, it would be 460 pounds of dead weight, and he wouldn't have been able to do it if his feet weren't on there. But why aren't you bringing that up? Well, now we got the Ultimate Warrior finally turning up for this feats of strength competition, for which he runs to the ring like a moron. Like, Anytime you get yourself in like a weightlifting or a power contest, you want to wear yourself out as quickly as possible by running to the ring.
That big mountain man is kind of cowering over in the corner.
Well, you know, he doesn't know what to expect here.
Who knows what to expect out of the water?
With very little preparation and warm up.
What's going to hit this poor guy? Guy's just a fan.
Don't be frightened, sir.
460
pounds. Fear not the Ultimate Warrior, big man. For I come to cause you no harm. I only come to destroy the challenges of you, Dino Bravo.
So he gets down, and they're going to do the exact same thing where, quote, John from West Virginia, which, by the way, sounds like a horrible sports radio caller, but anyway, he assumes the position, as it were, on the Warrior's back, but things don't quite go as planned. Well, at least for the Ultimate Warrior.
He's not here to harm you in any way. He is only here to dispel the challenge of Canadian Straw Man Dino Bravo. Sir, come on over. Please. Ultimate Warrior. Down on the mat.
He may be the ultimate
again,
pancake
I repeat,
when this is
the
over.
The weight of this man is 460 pounds. 460 pounds. John, go right ahead. Go right ahead. All right, he is up there. Okay, Ultimate Warrior. What? What's this?
You just gave
me... Wait a minute!
Whoa!
Bravo!
What?
Falling through an elbow!
See, I told you, McMahon, that he couldn't push up that big John character.
He didn't have a
ends right here. Kick this guy out. Ah, there's your Ultimate Warrior. We know who the strongest man is now.
We still don't know who the strongest man is.
We certainly do.
We know who the rottenest man is. It's
Bravo. Bravo did 5 push-ups when this Big John character sat down on the Warrior. The Warrior crumbled right underneath him. You saw it.
Crumbled? You saw what happened to this madman if, in fact, he is a mountain man. Came crashing down on the Warrior. That's what happened. And then Bravo followed through.
All Warrior had to do was 1 push-up, and he could have got him right off his back. He couldn't do it.
The Warrior's not thinking about a push-up right now. He's in pain.
He's thinking about a chiropractor right now.
I say the Ultimate Pancake kind of sounds like a really great breakfast, like a pancake the size of like a truck tire, you know, like one of those things. I had one of those in, I think it was Williams, Arizona, before going to the Grand Canyon. Place had like giant pancakes, and it was all you could eat, but if you could eat more than one, you were a total pig. Delicious. Anyway, anytime Jesse Ventura expresses astonishment the way that he did, like, hey, this guy learned how to wrestle awful quick, or like the time the Honky Tonk Man dressed up as Kim Chi, and he was like, wow, the Honky Tonk Man was Kim Chi all along. It's always fantastic when he does that. But the reason why this angle is great is because the fans picking him out made this whole thing work and made him just seem like a regular bumpkin. And I don't care for any of the behind the scenes of how they did that. The point is that it worked on TV to my 10-year-old eyes. Now I wish I could turn back the clock and watch wrestling through the lens that I did then, but hey, you know, the cat's out of the bag now. This worked so unbelievably awesomely. I mean, maybe not for Dino Bravo, because he's still kind of a nothing. But we got Earthquake now, or Canadian Earthquake, as he was known for the first few months. They actually taped a Dark Brother Love show, which they didn't air, but they did it for the live audience here, which seemed kind of strange, because it's not like they did any other Dino Bravo matches to explain that this guy... I didn't quite understand it from the results, but they did something like that to explain it to the crowd. But you've now created a main event level guy. Because John Tenta, of course, you know, you're not at work. I mean, this isn't some dude who spent 2 months in the performance center like you have now. This is a main event level guy ready made to be an Ultimate Warrior foil down the road. Which, humorously enough, never ended up happening. You never had... Yeah, there was probably a match or two on, like, a house show somewhere. But quickly forgotten in the shadow of Hulk Hogan and Earthquake. Makes it such an odd angle, though, because of the fact that Warrior wins the title at WrestleMania 6, and you have a ready-made opponent in Earthquake for him, but yet they never end up having that feud. So, yeah, it is strange that they did this angle this way, but it was a great way to introduce this new character. So at the end of the day, it all worked out. Just not for Dino Bravo. Because he kind of sucks.
I'm going to celebrate Turkey Day the ravishing way. I told my team to take the day off, sit back at home, put your feet up, and think about the Survivor Series. How can I go wrong? Look at my team. I've got Fabulous and the Rougeau Brothers. I've got Perfection and Mr. Perfect. And I've got Simply Ravishing in myself. What does Piper have? A rowdy Scotsman? A dude who looks like he just fell off the banana wagon? And 2 bushwhackers walking around airing their armpits out? Well, I don't mean to try to sound witty, and I'm not going to tell any jive. When I say Rude's Brood will have no pity, and Roddy's Rowdies will not survive.
That's beautiful. We appreciate the kisses.
I actually thought about raising this question, but the answer is actually kind of obvious. And whose career would you rather have had, Rick Rude's or Curt Hennig's? And then I thought about it more, and it's like, yeah, Curt Hennig by far, because he was around before Rude, was around after Rude. But then again, you had all these weird injury periods, and then he would come back, but... both of them are remembered fondly, but I think Mr. Perfect is remembered much more fondly because he was always a good worker relative to wherever he was. So, of course, we get the back-and-forth promos with just the team captains, unfortunately. I guess we couldn't herd the Bushwhackers and Snuka in with Roddy Piper. but it's Piper. I mean, the cocaine that went through this guy's system in 1989 is just Tony Montana-esque levels. And he's channeling the band Steeler's Wheel for this one.
Woo! Clowns to the left of you, jokers to the right, and there they are, stuck in the middle with you, man. You are, you told them to take the day off. They ought to live in a gymnasium. My boys, they ain't taking the day off. They're right now, they're biting truck tires right now. No, not them. Somebody's trying to pull Schnook out of the tree. Yes, they wave the armpits. They stink, man. They stink like nothing you ever smelled before. They're my boys, and I'm proud of them. Schnooker can't think of nothing, but he can gnaw on you all day. Bushwhackers, stink, don't care about nothing. They can gnaw on you. You see, because I got the rest covered, because, baby, I'm the Bo Jackson of WWF, and I stay alive because I invented hand jive.
I don't know about you, but I thought that Piper had said that he invented hand jobs, which is completely different from what he said. Like, I had to go back and listen to it for a second time. I mean, he's liable to say anything at this point. I don't know what the hell is going to come out of his mouth. Bo Jackson? I actually got a thing in my YouTube recommendations the other day. Something that happened like 5 years ago. I guess Bo Jackson was working with the White Sox, I think it was, in spring training. I think it was Adam LaRoche's kid comes up to him. And Bo Jackson is calmly explaining who he is. Like, yeah, I played for the Royals and the Angels and the White Sox. Oh, yeah, and I won the Heisman Trophy. I also played ball for the Raiders. And the kid's like, yeah, sure, old man. He just thought he was, like, making it all. He's, like, calmly explaining who he is. Like, I've never thought of Roddy Piper as a Bo Jackson-type character. Like, literally not a single time. But to close out this show, for the second time in a couple of months, and this is just kind of a weird coincidence, this happened with the May 1990 episode of Challenge that I did in the last 2 months, concluded with promos for the following weeks on Superstars Intercontinental Tournament Final. It also aired on Challenge as well, which I guess is why they put it at the end of that episode of Challenge. Tito Santana versus Mr. Perfect. Next week on Superstars of Wrestling, Mr. Perfect is taking on Tito Santana.
Tito Santana, you've got the opportunity of a lifetime. Next week, right here, you're going to face Mr. Perfect. And I promise you, I'll show the whole world that I am absolutely perfect.
And just in case that you forgot, he's perfection. Tito's not.
Mr. Perfect, you and I have a date here next week. The reason I've been successful here is because I jump at opportunities. Go ahead and bring the genius and whatever else you think you need. Because when all the dust settles, you are going to be down looking at me and you will no longer have a perfect record. Arriba!
I really don't want to be the well actually guy on this, because God knows that there's plenty of them out there. But there's a distinction to be made between a perfect record and an undefeated record. A perfect record would imply that there's not any time limit draws, and I've already established, both in this show and in prior episodes, that Mr. Perfect had plenty of time limit draws, many of them against Bret Hart. So you're not, it's not a perfect record. Like, if the Patriots had gone into Super Bowl 42 with a record of 15-0-1, they would not be going for the perfect season. I guess it would have been 17-0-1 going into Super Bowl, but if you have a tie on your record, it is not a perfect season. It's even more annoying in the NHL where they count like overtime losses as if, oh, they got a point in that one. It doesn't count as a regulation loss, so it's not really a loss. Well, they lost the game, so it doesn't matter. Mr. Perfect didn't have a perfect record. He had an undefeated record. He had not been defeated, and because I didn't see any DQ losses in there or anything, so... And that brings up the whole Andre the Giant undefeated thing, which, you know, we know is fraudulent because, you know, he went around to other places on a little tour with, like, Inoki and El Canek and that sort of stuff. But, you know, maybe I should stop worrying about this stuff so much. It's freaking professional wrestling. It just doesn't matter, like what Bill Murray said in Meatballs. And that'll do it for WWF Superstars for November 11th, 1989. On the lookout this weekend for GFA Live, Best of the WWF Volume 7 from Coliseum Video. I think we're going to be halfway through after we do that one. And I think it's got a Tony Garea match on it. So I don't think I have to sell you any more on that. Now, on the sportscasters, my pal Steve Bennett, he's got Jeff Pearlman this week. He's got a book out, Three Ring Circus, on the Kobe Shaq Lakers. I have to say, I'm kind of surprised that he did not push up the publication of that book more towards January when Kobe died in that helicopter crash, because it felt like, although maybe it would have felt a little crass doing that, but actually it worked out, because with the Lakers still playing, as I'm recording this, they lost to the Nuggets tonight in Game 3. They're probably still going to easily win that series, but geez, there's a point in that game where like they went on like a 20-0 run fairly late. It looked like the Nuggets were shaving points or something. But do check that out on the sportscasters. And on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, they're looking at it. Guys who never won the world title but were extremely over. So I'm immediately thinking of Roddy Piper, and the reasons why he didn't win the world title was probably because he didn't really need it, and he probably didn't really want it either. Although he probably was the fallback option if Hulk Hogan kind of, you know, got injured or left or something in 1985. You just turn him into a babyface and probably let him run with it for a while. So do check that out. Now, I went 1-2 in Vinny Vegas Corner last week. I got to tell you, I'm not really feeling the NFL this season. Like, just kind of watching. The Patriots played a very exciting game against Seattle on Sunday night, but I just, like, never felt it. Like, with no crowd there. Maybe I'll get into it as time goes along, but I'm going to skip the picks for this week. However, by missing that segment, it's time to bring back another old favorite of mine in YouTube Comment Theater. Now, as always, these are actual YouTube comments left by users on the video in question, and there are 191 comments. Obviously, I'm not going to get to all of them, because some of them are just of the variety of, oh, I miss when wrestling was like this. Like, okay, yeah, we get it. So I'll start out with Bill Hayes, who says, was not aware that Bret Hart was looking for a fight with the Black Widow. I thought it was the Widowmaker, Barry Windham. You know, I gotta say, I'm ashamed. I didn't even notice that Bret called him by the wrong name. I guess he's trying to get revenge for all those times that he was called Bret with two T's, or that one time that they put Bert Hart on the screen and I laughed uncontrollably for about 20 minutes. I don't know. Christy Perry says, HBK having no part of that goofy laughter. Well, I don't know, he did have kind of a serious face going on, but you know, it's just kind of a weird promo there. Momo Supremacy says, laugh my ass off. I had to go back multiple times and watch Marty Jannetty laughing along with the Anvil. Apparently everybody liked that promo, but it's also the screen cap on the YouTube video. So that kind of gets everybody's attention. Sometimes people comment without even watching. It's like the people who comment after reading the headline, but they don't actually read the article. Of course, sometimes I don't have to read the article because I know that Jason Whitlock's an asshole. Anyway, Mike Pope says, when wrestling had the best storylines. Well, I mean, that's a matter of some conjecture, but sure, hell of a lot better than the last few years. A lot of We Got Wood comments there. That really caught people's attention. Nightwave Radio says, man, I love wrestling too, but taping over an episode of 21 Jump Street? Not cool, LOL. Yeah, there was a 21 Jump Street thing that kind of, you know, popped in at one point. I wasn't a huge fan of that show, so there's really nothing to say about that. Akuma For You says, Wheeling didn't deserve to be put over like that at the beginning. And I say those nasty things about West Virginia. Now, to me, the most remarkable thing about West Virginia is Mike Dukakis won that state in 1988, which is just insane to think about. He's the last Democrat to win that state. Really, really strange. Giuseppe says, Hogan done great promos. Was he reading it or making it up? Hey, whatever it was, I like that Hogan promo because he's putting over his pals there, but they're also strong enough where you actually believe him. There's a little bit more credibility behind all of that. Surf Surfing says, Ultimate Pancake when this is over. LMFAO. Well, of course, yes. Jesse had a lot of good lines in this. A lot of good banter. Christy Perry says, Haku. It's a bunch of symbols. Andre. A bunch of symbols. Brother Love. Oh, that's some good stuff. And YouTube OG since 06 says, yeah, that's the actual username. Holy shit, I've had this memory my entire life, finally found it. This is when Earthquake, that's two words there, came down from the stands, and as a child I believed it. I never could find this. Wow, this is awesome. Yeah, I sure as hell believed it back then as well. Mark Zink says, Brother Love should have passed out a hat and asked for donations to help pay for the WWF roster's rehab. Well, that's not very nice, but yes, it does seem like after the crackdown on cocaine in 1987, it came roaring back in 89. That'll do it for YouTube comment data. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I may do that wrestling spotlight from December of 87 next week, but there are a couple of other ones, as I mentioned. Maybe I'll even dump back to a Survivor Series one, although, you know, this one I play a lot of clips in there, so it does take me a while to compile everything together. But, yeah, I certainly enjoyed doing this one, so I think I may go back to a similar well next week. But before I do that, I ask for a solid for anyone who has access to Apple Podcast reviews. If you haven't left one already, if you have, thank you very much. And please leave a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown, because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this particular podcast. Now, I've been leaving you with a final thought of late, and it's just been, you know, random, whatever has been coming into my head. And right now I have Inside the NBA on the television right now. And when they shoot from the wide angle camera where they get all four of them on screen, it is so damn comical how far away Charles Barkley is from Shaquille O'Neal. It's like literally a $13 Uber ride from one end of the table to the other because of the social distancing. I mean, they weren't kept that far apart when they had that fight in an NBA game back, I want to say it was like 1999. I don't know. Just some funny stuff from the NBA on TNT, which won't be that much longer because it's going to be ESPN only once the Western Conference Finals are over. So anyway, thank you so much for listening, and tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.